The Plain Talking Podcast, presented by Gethin Russell Jones.
Hello and welcome to this new episode of Plain Talking. This edition has an international focus. We're going to hear about Open Doors' newly published World Watch List and talk to an Iranian Christian about what it means to follow Christ in a deeply hostile environment. After that, Brother David Jardine will offer a prayerful reflection. Open Doors has once again published its World Watch List for 2026, comes out every January. And joining me now is Jim, who works for Open Doors. And welcome, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good to see you.
Jim, I wonder, for those who have no idea what the World Watch List is, give us an overview of what it is and why it is, if you like.
So it's a list compiled by Open Doors. That comes out in January every year for the past 30 years, and it's comprehensive in terms of methodology. There's a lot of research that goes into it, contacting partners and getting statistics, and it ranks the top 50 countries in the world where it's most difficult and most dangerous to be a Christian. So we look at things like violence and not being able to get certain types of jobs, bullying, a range of different lenses that we look through.
And generally speaking, as I understand it, apart from one year, the number one slot generally goes to North Korea.
It's a very tragic situation, but it's very difficult. And yet there's hundreds of thousands of Christians in North Korea, but they're by and large secret believers, and meeting together as Christians is not allowed. It's fascinating looking at the different trends in the different countries. Each one has a different context, and you can see general trends like surveillance in countries like Algeria and China. Violence in sub-Saharan Africa.
I mean, for years now, Open Doors has been drawing attention to the situation in sub-Saharan Africa. And it has become an increasingly hostile area for Christians and other minorities, I guess.
It is, yeah. And our job, we want to, we work closely with partners and, we really want to see things change. We're not in control of the narrative. I mean, in many ways, we're thankful that now it's been getting a lot more coverage in the media than what it was in previous years, But for example, we don't use the word genocide to describe what's happening. We don't feel we can say that, but we do feel that Christians are being disproportionately targeted, especially in the north. And yet there's a lot of, actors, a lot of influential people that are trying to deny that there's any religious aspect to the violence whatsoever. So we do believe it's important to speak up for Christians. We do believe in religious freedom for everybody, but it's with Christians where we have the relationship and the accountability because we're working with them. And if we don't speak up for brothers and sisters, who will?
And this year, Jim, your attention is being drawn to another continent. You're kind of coming to the Middle East, Syria. I'm wondering what's the concern you have there in Syria?
Well, Syria, had seemed to have experienced a relative quiet, the calmness after ISIS was territorially defeated there. And it's gone up to number 6. It was last year's number 18, now number 6 this year. And it's just quite, tragic. A lot of hopes have been shattered. There were the minorities, including Christians in the country, were promised freedom and safety. But sadly, there's been, just extremists. There was a suicide bombing in a church in Damascus last June. Mm-hmm. And that led to 22 people, losing their lives. There's been graffiti, hateful graffiti daubed on the walls of church buildings. And even in the Christian regions in Damascus, there's at the moment, there's, you know, sort of vans going through with loudspeakers calling on people to turn to Islam, you know. So it's a difficult situation, precarious at the moment. We need to pray for Christians in Syria. And so many, because of the bombing last June, they're not attending church at the moment because of their fears that it might happen again. So these are heavy subjects, but we need to be aware of them so that we can pray and do what we can.
I mean, I was speaking to a Syrian Christian a few months ago who made the point that Bashar al-Assad was, even though whose crimes and against his own people have been well documented, but it seems that as far as Christians were concerned, they seem to slip under the radar, really, that they and since his removal, they've become much more a target and a focus, which is quite a strange kind of situation, I guess.
Yeah, it is, and Syria wouldn't be the only country like that. There would be, you know, several around the world where Christians in a country are a minority, and in many ways, you know, driven by survival, you know, that they want the government to know that they're loyal citizens, that they're faithful citizens, and so they're seen that way, and so they get protection. But then, you know, with the Western mindset, wanting to see democracy, and so wanting to see different styles of government, and then it can result sort of like the soft belly of democracy, I suppose, the soft underbelly where you have extremists take advantage of that and then target Christians and other minorities.
In the report as well, Jim, there's a kind of understanding, recognition of surveillance. Some countries are, you know, use surveillance and spying on their own people, especially Christians, in order to make life difficult, arrest them, and worse. I mean, I'm wondering, is with the advancement of AI and digital technology and face recognition technology, that must be playing, you know, in the hands of some governments, that kind of technology is being used oppressively.
Yeah, definitely. There are some countries like China would be one, Algeria is another one, Tunisia, Vietnam, and yeah, they're using that. You know, if either Christians are perceived as a threat or whether the government feels that need to be controlled or monitored, you know, so in China at the moment, Christians can't reach out to youth, certain things they can't do, and Algeria, the Facebook group has been shut down as well. So it's, there's the facial recognition sometimes, but also monitoring of social media and trying to restrict freedoms of expression, freedom of worship.
Well, the report ends this year with, as it ends most years, to be fair, with some hope, some good news. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing what some of that good news might be, Jim.
Yeah, so a couple of things. One is, first of all, I suppose in Bangladesh, there were a lot of concerns that with the political unrest in the country, that it would lead to the situation facing Christians, who are a very small minority in the country, deteriorating. But thankfully, it hasn't done so. It's remained quite calm. So we're very grateful to God for that. And the other one is Susanna Coe, where there was a judgment made in her favor just before Christmas. Now, Susanna is from Malaysia. She's a lovely Christian lady. Her husband, Raymond Coe, was kidnapped in broad daylight by security forces in 2017. Susanna, since then, has been faithfully campaigning for justice to find out what's happened to him, if he's alive, where he is. And she's been here, you know. She's been in Wales, and she's a lovely lady. You wouldn't think that she'd be the type of person who could do that, but she's had the tenacity to do that. She feels God's given her courage and grace and strength, and so yeah, she's had a judgment in her favor, which security, the government has to pay her money, but it's not about the money. It's just it's the BBC reported it as a case that had gripped the nation, and I think this is good for Christians and for other minorities, so that them extremists will think twice maybe before they attack Christians or try to kidnap Christians. So we're thankful for her.
In fact, Susanna, we interviewed Susanna on this very podcast a couple of years ago now, I think. Yeah, very impressive.
Yeah, lovely lady.
One of the countries highlighted in the report is Iran. And of course, Iran is in the news almost permanently at the moment. And so it's a place of civil unrest. We're learning of outrageous injustices being committed against citizens by their own government. And of course, international relations with Iran are now at a breaking point. So joining me now, I'm glad to say, is Baha Rad. So welcome to you, Baha.
Thank you for having me. It's a blessing and pleasure to be able to be here and speak and share about the situation in Iran.
Well, thank you, Baha. And as I mentioned, Iran, I think this year is at about number 10. It's a list that no country should ever want to be in, but Iran is at number 10 in this list, which suggests a high level of torture and persecution and injustice against Christians. So I wonder, Baha, before we get to talk about what it's like to be a Christian in Iran, maybe your own story, because I realize as well, Baha is not your real name. So for security purposes, that has been changed. So tell us a little bit about your story and what your perspective is in all this.
I will start my journey when it goes back to Iran, when I was only 10 years old. Actually, I born into a Muslim family. And of course, Muslim society. Actually, my father's side are very conservative Muslims, and my mom's family, strong Muslims as well. But when I was 10 years old, my father was the first person in our whole family and extended family, and the only person in my society and community that accepted Jesus as Savior and Lord. And he became Christian. He converted from Islam to Christianity. And very soon after that, he started to talk about it. You know, he's shared with us. I have siblings as well. So with me and my siblings, with my mom, and of course, with his friends and family members. I was very young. I felt that, you know, he's sharing something different than what I learned from our traditions and culture and school. But I didn't thought that it's going to be a big deal. Until family started to really respond to it in a very harsh way. Like my uncles, aunts, grandparents, they started to call him infidel. They tell him that he is ashamed of family. He's betraying the traditional and cultural things that they have. So they started to really reject him. And I remember that whenever we gathered in homes for meals, for traditional or cultural celebration, the topic of Christianity was always on fire, and all the family members would like put my dad in the corner, try to convince him go back to Islam. But like it was very hard for me as a child to see that, and I was really confused about what is the truth, because my dad was sharing the Bible stories with us, and I was hearing a loving story of a God who really loves us, who really cares about us, who wants to save us. But at the same time, I was listening a whole family that is saying that, no, these are all lies. You guys are being brainwashed. And beside the rejection of the family, there is no church in Iran. Like there are buildings, but most of them are closed. And the couple of them that are left open are for Assyrian and Armenian Christians, which are historically Christians, and they are not converts. So they have buildings to have their services and worships and programs, but they are not allowed to have Iranians or Persian-speaking people getting involved in their gatherings or having even their own worship in Persian language. So basically all Iranians who are convert from Islam to Christianity do not have any place to gather to worship. So that's why they need to find another in a very difficult way. For my dad, it was that he heard the gospel from the satellite TV program that was launched in Persian. And then through them, he got connected to a house church. And And soon after that, because of, you know, getting mature in his faith and starting preaching the gospel, going to different cities to plant the house church and serve other Christian converts. So he was arrested. There was a spy in their group and he was recorded by camera secretly. And then he was in prison two times, the first time for 2 months and for the second time for 1 year. And in that time, I was realizing that, oh, the pressure is not only from our family, it's mostly also from the government that they are saying that your dad was doing actions against national security, propagandas against the state. And all I knew that he was just teaching Bible to believers in their homes and singing worship songs. And in that 1 year, it was really, really difficult for me, for my mom, for my siblings, that having no connection with our dad, and he was arrested in a different city. And he kept telling us not to come to visit me. It is not safe if you come here. So for a whole year, I couldn't see my dad. And it was very difficult and very confusing. And during that time, the government tried to call my mom because my mom was a teacher in that time, saying that if you don't want to lose your job, if you don't want to bring danger for your children, if you don't want to get arrested like your husband, just better to be quiet. Do not talk about what's happening to you and your family with your colleagues in your classroom. And we are monitoring you, basically. So it was a very hard time of completely loneliness, isolation, not really knowing what will happen to my dad, what will happen to us. And it was really difficult as a teenager specifically. And on his release, actually, the government directly told him that, you know, if we get you for the third time, then it will be execution and we will be watching you. So be careful about where you go, what you do. So after his release, like, threatening calls and messages kept coming to his phone, and he basically couldn't meet with the other Christians that he was in touch with. We couldn't go to house church anymore. And it was a huge isolation for him and us. And after a couple of months, he said that my heart is for people. I want to share about my faith. I want to just be in a relationship with other Christians to have worship, to serve them, to just practice my faith, basically. But it was not allowed. It was not normal to do that. It was a crime to do that. So with the counseling of his pastor, we decided to leave the country, which was not really easy to leave everything behind, your friends, your family members, your home, basically all you had behind. But like, there was no more chance to stay and to be Christian and to live out your faith. So that's how we had to leave the country and start the process of 14 years of being displaced as refugees. And it was very difficult to leave those days as well. But like, God was faithful during all these times, and in the times that we were thinking that why we are going through this situation, there was some voices I could hear from God saying that, you know, I am here with you and things will be fine one day. I didn't know how, I didn't know when, but just I could feel his presence. And what really encouraged me was that when my dad was released from prison, he said that even though it was very difficult being interrogated, being beaten up, being kept in cells for 4 months in different rooms, different methods of violence, and to just force him back to Islam and just to expose the other identities of other Christians that he was in contact with, even though it was terrible. But the moment that he was moved to the public cell, so there were many people that he could share the gospel with, even in prison. And there were 23 people that accepted Jesus during a couple of months that he was there. And it was really encouraging to see that even in the places that we might think that it's so dark and nothing is really happening, maybe even God is absent in that place, but still God is there. God is working, and he's working in ways that we never ever imagine. And that was really encouraging to hear that. And that was actually a hope that it's, even though we are relocating, even though we are going to a place that we have no family, no friend, we have no idea about, but the God who protected us and who brought us to that location is able to open new ways. And this really happened. And we were able to connect with Iranians in that city and country. We were able to find a house church, new house church, and at the same time get connected with the people back in Iran through online ministries. And yeah, basically that's the story. But like the threats and challenges never stops, even though now that I'm in a different country, in a safer country, but like difficulties, challenges, threats, monitoring, and these things all the time follows you wherever you go. And if you want to stay in ministry, if you want to help the persecuted believers in Iran, you're always not only yourself at risk, but also your family and also the network that you're serving is all the time at risk.
Wow, thank you, Baha. That's a really vivid, personal, extraordinary account of your family and your dad and you and how your family has come to faith and found some safety, but the risks remain. I'm wondering, Baha, what it was it like being a Christian in somewhere like Iran today?
Yeah, so, I'm not only sharing my experience, but also because it kept the connection with the people in Iran. So I'm talking about the realities that is happening every day for Christians in Iran, is that, you know, they are very, very brave because they know that going out of your home to just gather in a house church, which is a normal house, just a few believers, not a large number of believers getting in a place, they know that this is not safe. They know that government is able to find them, to arrest them, and to label them as people who are doing acts against national security, who are the corruptions on earth, who are the people against Islam and government and all those things. So they are aware of these labelings. They are aware of the persecution and danger. But still, they have this faith, this courage to gather. And they know that the moment they leave home, there is no guarantee of anything that might happen. So every time they leave home, they need to check their phones of any Bible application they have. They need to delete that. If they have any contact number of their pastors or friends, within the country or outside the country, they need to be careful that how they name them, if they want to delete them or keep them somewhere else. The messages, the Bible verses, chats, prayer meeting, anything that is related to Christianity, any material need to be deleted from the phones, because anytime in the street, police can stop you, can check your phone, can check your bag, check your car, and any source, any Bible, any material, anything related to Christianity can put you in the risk. And the moment that finally you go around and you finally get to a place called a house church, you always need to be careful and you need to come with an excuse, like bringing some food, showing that, oh, we are friends gathering in a place just to eat. And be careful not to bring a lot of Bibles with yourself. So just one Bible maybe in a whole house church, even that's risky, but like that's the safest to do. So people need to be careful. I hear Christians are saying that when we play worship songs, when we are singing worship songs, we need to do it with a very, very low voice, just in case neighbors wouldn't hear about this and report this. So even singing worship songs become a dream, become a wish for Iranian Christians in Iran, that they have no place literally to sing the song of Jesus Christ. And also when they gather, not only these limitations, but also this fact that government sends spies everywhere is a huge thing. Because when you reach out to other people to share about your faith, to preach the gospel, sometimes they seem friendly, sometimes they seem open, but you never know if they're really curious about Christianity, that they want to join you, or are they just pretend to be curious and they are just spies of the government that are coming to your house church to get the information of the people, and just one day the officers, police officers, would knock your door and come in and arrest all of the group. So these challenges are very difficult, and just not being able to express what you believe, not being able to share about who you are, what you believe in, is very difficult. And it's not only within the house church or within the family. When Christians are exposed, they cannot have education. I have a number of young people that are Christians But the moment, for any reasons, were exposed that they are Christians, they lost the opportunity to continue or finish their education in university. And there are people losing their jobs because of being Christians. And there are people who cannot even get married because in the system of the country, the moment that you want to go to office to register your marriage, the first question to the both wife and husband is, what is your religion? So in that moment, people are always thinking, if I say that I'm a Christian, I will not be able to have my job get done. And if I say that I'm a Christian, then I need to go for further investigation, questions, maybe arrest and further things. And finally, I will not be able to formally and legally get married. So these are the challenges that systematically authorities try to put on Christians, whether on social level or cultural level or family. And most of the time in the case of arrestment, the thing is that government put a lot of pressure on Christians, denying them the medical care, denying to have access to lawyer, and giving heavy prison sentences to them, travel bans, exile within the country, and a lot of high bail that within this economy in the country, paying such bail for even temporary release is very difficult for the families. And in the past, we could see that the arrestment were more on men, that they would get the man and just, torture them, question them, arrest them. But we see now that it is expanded to even women and young people. So we see that the violence and the pressure from government on Christians became larger, bigger, and on different. They no matter what is your gender, what is your age, they just oppress if you are a Christian and if you are active in your ministries. So yeah, this is the day-to-day life of many Christians, that they need to be careful and have wisdom and discernment about what they do, where they go, who they talk to, how they gather, how they do their ministry. So it's always being on alert, and it's not easy to always live in that condition and always need to be careful about what to do and what is the safest way to just simply be practicing your faith.
And Baha, at the moment, we're hearing a great deal, and we have done for several months now, about these widespread protests that have been taking place across different cities in Iran, where people are protesting about lots of things, I guess, about civil rights, about the cost of living and simply getting by. And these very disturbing reports of thousands of people now being killed. This must be having an unimaginable impact on the lives of ordinary people, not just Christians, but everybody in Iran. It must be a terrifying place to be at the moment.
Yes, correct. It's more than a month now that, as you mentioned, it started with economic reasons that it collapsed and just making bread and basic needs of families became so difficult because the money that you're earning is not enough for the things that you need to pay. So it started with that reason. But when we look at the history of the Islamic Republic since the revolutionary happened 47 years ago, so there are protests happening, starting with different reasons, like woman life, freedom thing. And before that, for different reasons, the protest starts. But soon after that, 2-3 days after the starting of any protest, it soon changed to saying that we are done with this regime. We do not want this because people are looking for freedom, for justice, for human dignity, for life. And just for any kind of reason that they protest, at the end, the response of the government is the same, that the answer is with bullets. They arrest people. They say that if you ask for justice and freedom, it means that you are against Islam. And if you're against Islam, you're against the government. And they themselves really believe that they are the representer of God on the earth and whoever is against them. So they have the right to basically kill them, execute them, and just, take the control of everything. So this is very sad to keep hearing the news of more than 36,000 people being killed. This is what report says. But for more than 2 weeks, we didn't have any connection with Iran. The internet was completely cut off. And the local people say that the numbers can be two or three times even more, because what they sell is not as any time before. In the past, we had thousands of people getting into the street to protest, but this time it was estimated up to 30 million people going to streets for protests. And regardless of ethnicity, regardless of religion, regardless of gender, age, now this is the time that we see the unity in Iranian people more than any time before. They are shoulder to shoulder, just asking for dignity, for justice, for freedom. And what do we see from the government is just not only killing them in the street, but also if they are injured and going to hospitals, just police officers go to hospitals, either kill them on the spot in the hospital or rearrest them from hospital and take them to unknown locations. And there are thousands of people getting executed after arrests. And not only the protesters, but also doctors, nurses, lawyers, firefighters, the people who are trying to just doing their job and help people, like injured people in those situations, they are also being arrested and they are facing execution. So what we are seeing is that government is trying to oppress the protests harsher than before, more violently than before. And Iranians inside the country are living in fear currently. And they recently, for the past couple of days, they had a little access to internet, but they are saying that we are being monitored. We cannot say what is happening to us. We cannot share videos, photos. We cannot really say what is really happening because they can find us easily. And just being in contact with the people outside the world is a good reason just to execute us. And for these matters, this knowing the reality that how bad, how horrible the reality is difficult. But we, from what we heard so far, it's really beyond imagination. And but there's a hope. At the same time, there's a hope that people are hopeful that finally the end is close and they are really seeking a change in the country, and not only people inside the country, but millions of Iranians outside the country that they were displaced for different reasons. Some like me, because of persecution, because of not having the freedom to share about their fate. Some because of economical reasons. Some because of just being opposite thinking of the government. And different reasons people left the country, but they never wanted to leave. They were forced to leave. And now more than 90 million Iranians around the world have this desire to go back to the country. And they are protesting in UK, in Canada, in America, in European countries, in Japan, in Korea. People, Iranian people went to streets still ongoingly every week, every weekend. They are going to streets just saying that, just be the voice for Iranian people, that the reality that they are living is horrible. And if there is nothing changed in these moments, if freedom is not guaranteed, and if we do not see a positive side as a result of all this death, we would have 90 million people traumatized. But what they saw, because each person either lost a beloved person or they observed their neighbors, friends losing someone, and the number of the people getting killed, majority young people. So now we have basically elderly people in the country or very, very young. So the young and young adult of the population of the Iran basically died. And this is very impactful. And the Church of Iran is not part of, like different from the rest of the society. They are part of it because they are the same. Like Baha'i people or different religious minorities have been oppressed with the same reason that now the whole country is being oppressed by the government. And minorities, I can say that they have double vulnerability, because they always have this title of being spies for the Western countries or being in connection or doing spying and being espionage for the foreign countries. So in these scenarios, what the government always tries to say is that, oh no, the people, like the people of Iran are okay with the government, and only those minorities, specifically combat, Christian combat, who are connected with the West, are trying to do things against national security, and they are always blaming minorities in this situation even more than before. So Christians are in double risk, double danger, just because not because of protesting, but also adding their faith into that and making things more complicated in their process in court and in those situations.
And finally, Brother David Jardine is drawing our attention to test match cricket.
The cricket between England and Australia, just before and just after Christmas, was a disappointment for England fans. The England team had left these shores in November, with high hopes of winning back the Ashes. Some commentators over here said it would be a close contest. Others forecast that England would win narrowly. But the contest wasn't going too long before it became obvious that Australia were much the stronger team, and before long they had won the series overwhelmingly. I remember when it was very different. In 1954, England went to Australia and won convincingly. They had a great fast bowler called Frank Tyson, who was too hot for the Australians to handle. I was just 11 years of age at the time. It was the first time I could remember England playing in Australia. My father and I used to listen to the commentary as we took our breakfast. Radio reception was not nearly as good as it is today. The sound went up and down, sometimes nearly fading away. Nonetheless, it was exciting, listening to commentary on a match as it was happening at the other side of the world. Today, reception is very different. Coverage of matches today is normally on Sky TV. I don't have Sky, but I have no doubt that pictures and sound of the recent series were both perfect. This is just one example of the amazing technological advances that have been made in recent years, and the pace seems to be quickening up all of the time. A friend who has an AI app told me recently that he asked AI to give him a synopsis of the last chapter of a book called Absolute Surrender by the South African writer Andrew Murray. Andrew died in 1917, and many people in Christian circles today will not have heard of him. But AI knew him, and inside a few seconds, the synopsis had been provided. When I read it, it was absolutely brilliant. This seems to me to be astonishing, and we could give examples like this from every area of life. But if technological advances are amazing, they also do have great limitations. For all this greater efficiency, has it made us any happier? I don't think so. Relations between the great powers seem to me to be as bad as at any time since the Second World War. And even on the level of personal relationships, there doesn't seem to be the warmth and friendliness that I remember as a younger person. Are people more self-centered today? Is there less community spirit? You can't always generalize, but I suspect that there isn't the closeness of relationships that there used to be. I wonder if Clint Eastwood, famous film star and director, now 95 years of age, recently gave us a clue as to why this is. I saw a headline, something he said, "I risked it all to follow Jesus." He said that he risked his whole career and reputation by giving his life to Jesus. Those were the very words he used. He said that before, in spite of all his amazing success in the film industry, within himself, something was missing. But when he gave his life to Jesus, he found a peace which he had never had before. Is that what St. Augustine was referring to when he said, "Thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee"?
Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Plain Talking. If you have, please subscribe to it and leave a review wherever you found it. Plain Talking is sponsored by The Plain Truth, a magazine of understanding. For more information, please visit plain-truth.org.uk. That's it for now, and so until the next podcast drops, God bless from all of us at Plain Talking.